Okay, good evening, everyone. I hope everyone had a nice Thanksgiving. This is the fourth and final class in the Discovering Buddhism module, Samsara and Nirvana. And it's the last Discovering Buddhism class for this calendar year. And another module will start up in January. And a number of the a good part of that module will be taught by Venerable Robina, who will be in residence as a visiting teacher during parts of January and February. So let's begin with some meditation, as always. I know everyone's had a probably hectic last few days, a lot of traveling probably, a lot of interacting with family and friends. And for some reason, we've all decided to come to Kadampa Center this evening. So let's take the most advantage of that possible, this little moment, for a little bit of quietness and reflection. So we'll begin our meditation. As always, we begin by checking our posture. First thing we check is our back. A little bit straighter than we normally sit. If you're on a cushion, it's good to be a little bit towards the front of the cushion. If you're sitting in a chair, don't lean back, but sit forward a little bit. Your head is straight on your shoulders, maybe just a couple degrees in front of the vertical, but not tilted to one side or the other. Eyes are either just slightly open, just letting in a little bit of light, or lightly closed. The mouth is lightly closed. So the best place is to, for the tongue is to have it against the upper gum. That prevents you from drooling during your meditation, which is considered to be not cool. Shoulders are down, not hunched up around your ears, but down and a little bit back so your chest is open. Upper arms away from the sides of the body. Right hand on left with thumbs touching. Just below the navel. And legs in a position that you find stable and non-distracting. If you're sitting on the floor, any form of crossing your legs is fine. If you're sitting on a chair, you can place your feet on a cushion if need be, but try and have your feet flat. So go ahead and check your posture now. Kind of do a total body scan from the top of your head on down. See if you find any sources of discomfort or tension and identify those now. Wiggle them out. Or if there's a scratch you have to deal with, go ahead and deal with that now. The point of the posture is not to be uncomfortable or to have it being a distraction. The point is the posture is stable, and something, once you establish it, you can just set it aside and not pay attention to it. It's kind of self-maintaining. And having established our posture, we'll now do a simple form of 9-round breathing. Deep breaths from the abdomen, with the abdomen expanding on the in-breath, pulling the diaphragm down so our lungs are completely filled. Then when we exhale, the stomach is pulled back towards our spine. The diaphragm is pushed up and we completely exhale. That actually, from a physiologic point, stimulates the vagus nerve, which actually slows down our heart rate slightly. So it's something we want that's very effective, but you don't want to do it for prolonged periods of time because you actually can cause yourself to faint just by sitting and breathing deeply like that. And again, that's another thing that's not cool, to fall off your cushion in a faint. So we'll do the pattern of closing the left nostril, three breaths in and out through the right nostril, closing the right nostril, three breaths in and out through the right nostril, and then three breaths in and out through both nostrils. And now we allow our breathing to return to its normal pattern. And as always, we begin our meditation by setting our motivation. Our reason for coming to Kadampa Center this evening, for taking time out of our busy schedule to sit quietly, work with our mind, and then discuss the teachings. And whatever motivated us to come here this evening is a perfectly fine motivation. If it's just out of curiosity, great. If we just want a little bit of peace and quiet during this hectic time of year, that's fine. But it's said that the most powerful motivation, the one that really gives the energy to our meditation practice, is what's referred to as the bodhicitta motivation. The motivation that I am doing this activity, i.e. this meditation, so that I can train my mind and be of more benefit to others. That I want to develop my positive qualities so that I can help others. That I want to achieve my highest potential of wisdom and compassion so that I can help others. My family, my friends, my coworkers, my pets, and ultimately expand that out to include everyone. So think along those lines for just a minute. It certainly doesn't seem natural or normal to think that way. It seems very strange, almost grandiose. But we're just imagining that, getting in the habit of thinking that way. And having set our motivation, we now begin the actual meditation practice. And this will be a very simple concentration meditation. A meditation in which we develop our mind's capacity for concentration. We have a little bit of it, but we're not very good at it. And it's a quality that will be extremely beneficial on our spiritual path. So all we're going to do is place our mind, our awareness, on the movement of the breath in and out through our nostrils. The physical, tactile sensation of breath moving in and out. Just take a minute and experience that. It's a little bit cool. And it's just the natural rhythm of the breath. So that's all we pay attention to. Movement of the breath. We're not thinking about it. We're not describing it. We're just experiencing it directly. Mind and breath become inseparable. Mind and breath become one phenomena. And every time, as is inevitable, we notice that our mind has wandered off, thinking about something that happened today, or something we need to do on the way home, or an itch we have on our leg. We just set that aside. Don't get angry with ourselves. Don't go off on a tangent about how bad I am at meditating, how I'm not making any progress. Just set that aside and come back to the breath. Over and over and over again. And that is the process of meditation. A very simple concentration meditation. The mind stays on the chosen object. It's not going blank. It's not ceasing to exist. It's not spacing out. It's a very alert state, alert and aware of the breath. And we can end our meditation with a brief dedication. We can acknowledge that we've done something a little bit unusual, a little bit difficult. We've made an effort that's made a positive imprint on our mind stream. Our mind is a little bit different than when we began the meditation. We've just slightly developed the ability to concentrate, and we think, may that positive imprint on my mind stream not be lost, but may it ripen in the future in a way that is a benefit to others. Everybody can wiggle around, get their blood circulating. Samsara and Nirvana. Who can give me a definition of samsara? The cycle of rebirth, okay. Not endless, okay, because it can have an end. It may seem endless, but it's the cycle of being born, getting old, getting sick, and dying, and then according to the Buddhist philosophy, being reborn. And there's one characteristic of that that's very important. Without choice, it's involuntary. Who here chose to have the body that they have? Can anybody remember making that choice? Who chose to have the mind that they have? Who chose their parents? Who chose where they're going to grow up? Not many of us. And that's the quintessential characteristic of samsara, that we have no choice in the matter. Our opinion doesn't really count for much in this cycle. What is it that determines which body we get, which mind we get, which parents we get, which brothers and sisters we get? Karma. Our past actions of body, speech, and mind. Everything that we say, everything that we think, everything that we say, everything that we do physically makes an imprint on our mind stream that will ripen in the future and determine our future experience, including such things as our body, our mind, our parents, our siblings, our children, our characteristics, our likes, our dislikes, our attitudes about things, all determined by karma, not something that we have chosen. Okay, we have created the cause for it, so we are responsible for it, but it is not something that we are choosing voluntarily. So that is samsara, this endless cycle. And what's the basic experience in that cycle, according to the Buddhist point of view? Suffering, which can mean severe, extreme physical suffering, or it can mean just mental unsatisfactoriness, or not being satisfied, not getting enough. Excuse me, I've got a tickle in my throat. Of always wanting more. So samsara is being reborn into an existence characterized by getting old, getting sick, dying, and suffering. So it kind of proves, as people say, that Buddhism is a very gloomy religion. If you stop there, okay, that's the first noble truth. What's the second noble truth that the Buddha taught? The origin of suffering, that there's a cause, and we'll talk about that more Then it gets really good. The third noble truth is the cessation. It is possible for suffering to completely end, to be completely free of suffering, completely free of mental and physical suffering. Not just diminish it, not just be a little bit less depressed, not just be a little bit less miserable, not to be a little bit more happy, but to be completely and permanently free of suffering. And that also is the result of karma. That's also something that doesn't just happen. It's something we have to create the causes for. It's not just random. And that condition of being free of suffering is called nirvana. Yes, okay. The other word in the title of this class. Nirvana is the state of being completely free of all personal suffering. It's not the same thing as enlightenment, but it's a very great attainment. And what's the main way that we achieve a state of nirvana? Realization of emptiness, yeah. We eliminate ignorance from our mind. Okay? Ignorance meaning not seeing reality as it exists. Stop hallucinating. Stop projecting a type of reality that doesn't exist and believing in it, but seeing everything. Others, objects, events, and most importantly, ourself as we really exist, which is ultimately our ultimate emptiness, which means our lack of inherent, independent existence. We project a false sense of self onto this body and mind. We label it as Robbie. We think it's real. We think Robbie exists in that way. We believe in that, and we cater to his every whim. That's what our life is about. We're catering to the whims of something that doesn't even exist. It's this false sense of Robbie or self that we project onto the impermanent coming together of a body and mind. Now, that's not the subject of this course, but it's kind of at the core of what we're talking about. So, we understand what samsara is. We understand what nirvana is. The Dalai Lama always says when he gives a teaching, we all want to be happy. We all want to be free of suffering. That's a completely valid aspiration. Because if we're happy, we're not hurting others, for one thing. But it's something that is innate in the human experience of wanting to be happy. We want to get out of samsara, this uncontrolled, involuntary cycle of suffering. We want to get into nirvana, this place where we're completely free of suffering. Not physical places, but mental states. Okay, mental experiences. An experience of complete non-suffering, an experience of complete happiness. Okay? So, one way the Buddha gave us to understand this was what he called the wheel of life. And I'm not going to put the tanka up here tonight because I think everybody's very familiar with it now. There's one outside the door if you're not familiar with. And we still have some for sale in the store. Yeah. It's traditionally placed outside a meditation room because it's such an important topic for meditation. So we've talked about samsara. We've talked about nirvana. So within the wheel of life, there's all sorts of iconography, and I'm not going to go over that tonight. But in the center, well, let's say we have an outer wheel. And then we have a little hub that turns that wheel. Okay, and typically in the hub, what will we find there? What's the iconography that we'll see there? The most important one, a pig, okay? There'll be an image of a pig, a cock or a rooster, and a snake. What's the pig represent? Ignorance, okay? Not understanding reality, not seeing things as they are. The cock or the rooster represents attachment, okay? Clinging to things, overestimating their value. And the snake indicates anger or ill will, the wish to harm. And sometimes the cock and the snake are depicted coming out of the mouth of the pig because the pig's a really bad dude in all of this. Ignorance, not seeing reality. But these three afflictions or negative minds are what turns the wheel of life, samsaric life, okay? Buddhas and enlightened beings are not in samsara. They're outside this uncontrolled, involuntary wheel. But we're stuck in it, okay, in samsara. So it's turning the wheel, and around the wheel we'll find what are referred to as the 12 links. And let's see. We'll go through these just as a kind of review. Okay, the first link is ignorance, yeah. We've already talked about that. And specifically in the wheel of life, in terms of keeping us in samsara, what ignorance of what? It itself, yeah. Particularly, mainly ignorance about how I exist, how my mind and body exist. That's the kind of ignorance here that is on. I mean, it refers to ignorance in general, but it specifically, it's talking about ignorance of the self. Okay? The next link is, yeah, sometimes it's referred to here as karmic formation. Okay. But that's karma of body, speech, and mind. The next one is consciousness, our mind. And the Buddhist concept of mind is that it's without beginning, without end. Consciousness, our consciousness has no beginning. There's always a previous moment of consciousness we can find, and it has no end. There's always a future moment of consciousness that will follow. Okay. Next one is name and form, and what are we talking about there? Body and mind, okay. Body and mind, okay. Next one. Yeah, the six sources. And what does that refer to? Yeah, in Buddhism, there's six senses. There are the five that we normally think of, and there's also a mental sense. Okay, senses are anything that perceives something else. Okay, so my hand can, my tactile sense is what feels that. Okay, my auditory sense is what hears that. My mental sense is what remembers something or thinks of something or plans something. Okay, so in the same way it perceives phenomena. Okay, so our six senses perceive phenomena. We talked last week a little bit about how there's an external object, there's the sense mind, and then there's the sense organ. And it's the three of them interacting that actually cause us to experience the world around us. But that's not the subject of this course either. Okay? Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Six is contact. Okay, that means that's what I'm referring to. There's an external phenomena, a cushion. That I have a sense organ, an eye that perceives cushion, and I have a sense mind that processes that information. And that's what we refer to as contact. External object, sense organ, and the corresponding mind that goes with that sense organ. Buddhism talks about all sorts of minds or consciousnesses arising and going out of existence. Okay? External object, sense organ, sense mind, the three of them together, That's referred to as contact. That's the way we experience our world, through contact. And after contact comes... attachment may be part of it, but what's a bigger term for the next one? Feeling, okay? Yeah. Which means pleasant feelings, unpleasant feelings, and neutral feelings. Contact inevitably leads to feeling. Again, the fact that we're in the dentist chair and he's drilling on our back molar, that inevitably, uncontrollably, involuntary causes an unpleasant feeling. You can't sit there and just mentally change it into a pleasant feeling. Why can't you? Because most of us don't have the karma to experience a drilled-in molar as a joyful experience, okay? This is not just labeling it as pleasant or unpleasant. This is that instinctive feeling that we have no control over. You know, we look at a pink sweater, that feeling of a nice feeling arises, okay? We look at a ugly blue jacket, an unpleasant feeling arises. We don't have any control. We go through life, we like things, we don't like things, we don't care about things. That's all the result of karma. We've created it in the past, but we don't have any control over it right now. And after feeling comes craving, which is, if it's a pleasant feeling, I want more of it. If it's an unpleasant feeling, I want to push it away. If it's a neutral feeling, I don't care. And for this, we do, through spiritual practice, we can work on this link here. Okay, that's a good place. Now, that's where the teachings on impermanence and such really start to help us practically in this life. And also concentration. We become more aware of those feelings. We're seeing what our mind is doing. And we can start to weaken that a little bit. We can't eliminate it, most of us. I don't know about y'all. But this is where the kind of day-to-day spiritual practice that most of us are doing can come in useful. Okay? After craving comes grasping. Yeah. Which is just an extreme form of craving, even just kind of out of control. And the next one is becoming. And I didn't explain that real well last week, so we'll talk about that more. But this is, we'll get into this, but this is the karmic conditions that cause us to move into the next lifetime. And I'll talk a little bit more about this. After becoming, we have, we can just say birth, okay, or conception. And then we have old age and death. Yeah. That's where we are right now. Welcome to the club. Okay. Ignorance. Okay, so I'm going to start and go through these, make a few more points. Ignorance primarily of the self. I think there is this Robbie that exists that needs to be catered to and needs to be taken care of. That's ignorance, okay? It's a false conception. But out of that ignorance, I create a lot of karma, okay? Some of it good karma. I do some good things. This is not meant to be gloomy, but we're talking about samsara here, so I create a lot of negative karma. Well, how do we create negative karma? What's one way of outlining how we do that? Non-virtuous actions, okay? The 10 non-virtuous actions. Put in the actions. Okay, these are such things as killing, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct, our speech, gossip, idle gossip, attachment, anger, and ignorance, okay? Actions of body, speech, and mind. I mean, it's possible, you know, to do those with a good motivation, but most of the time, they're done out of ignorance. Those are the types of actions that create negative karma, karma that will cause us to suffer in the future. Okay? That makes imprints on my mind stream that in some point in the future will cause problems for me. Okay? When I say something harsh to someone, it may hurt them, but it definitely will hurt me in the future. Okay? And so on for the other 10 non-virtuous actions. So these actions that create karma that is placed on our consciousness, okay? Ignorance leads to non-virtuous actions, leads to karma, which makes an imprint on our consciousness. Well, actually, yeah. Okay, makes an, so I'm going to make, get kind of graphic here. Make conscious, this is a stream of consciousness, one moment of consciousness after another, okay? So this makes an imprint on our mental continuum. Okay, gets on and hops a ride, and it's stuck. It's going to be there. It's not going to be lost. And at some point in the future, that karmic seed is planted there, will ripen, and what does it do? It's made an imprint, and then when these, particularly in the wheel of samsara, what are we talking about when karma ripens? We're talking about karma that throws us into the next rebirth. So we're talking about strong karmas here, okay? Typically, it's going to be one of the 10 non-virtuous actions that's done intentionally, okay? It's done with full awareness that is completed. And then we say, whoopee, when it's completed. That makes a really strong karmic action. So we're talking here about karmic imprints that are placed on our soul consciousness that are so strong that they throw us into our next lifetime, throw us into that body and mind that we didn't choose. It's so, the karma is so strong. Okay? Another point, a point I didn't make clear last week, I touched on, but this is, these things are not necessarily sequential. Okay? In fact, these three, grasping, or craving, grasping, and becoming, these are, let's see, how can I put this? Typically, these are going to be occurring right here during this process. Okay? These are typically craving. This refers to the karma. What's going on at the time of our death that allows this particular karma, throwing karma, to ripen? Okay? And for most of us, as we get sick, at the time of death, there's a lot of grasping onto our body and mind. We don't want to leave it. There's a lot of craving for a happy rebirth if we accept the reality of rebirth. Okay? And there is this craving and grasping is a determinant of what karma ripens at the time of our death, which throwing karma ripens at the time of our death. Okay, so we are going through this sequence, ignorance, karmic formation, and placing a seed on consciousness continuously. We're doing that over and over and over again. So we're planting lots of throwing karmas on our consciousness. The craving and grasping and becoming help determine which one of those karmas ripens at the time of our death. Because we've all got countless karmic seeds on our mind that could ripen at the time of death. So if we have a death that's characterized by craving and grasping, the becoming would allow a very negative karma possibly to ripen. Okay? If craving and grasping, if we've diminished those in our mind stream, if they're not as strong, then possibly a more favorable karmic seed could ripen. Even though we're still in samsara, so we're still going to be born into one of those six realms that's characterized by suffering. But it may be the karmic seed for a human rebirth. Okay? So, this is what's happening at the time of death that leads up to this throwing karma ripening, kind of picking out which one's going to ripen at that moment. Okay? Questions or comments so far? Okay? So that throwing karma, that's what determines the body and mind that we get. This is the moment of conception. Okay? The egg and sperm come together in the mother's womb. If we're not miscarried or aborted or whatever, our six senses develop. We begin to have contact even while in the womb with the amniotic fluid and the warmth of the mother's body and so on. And even at that stage, we're creating feeling is arising. The amniotic fluid feels good. We like the warmth. There are a lot of pleasant sensations. Then when we go through the birth canal, we say, this is not so pleasant. I don't like this part. Okay, so this is development in the womb. So name and form, six sources, contact and feeling go together. Over here, birth and death are really describing the same part of the cycle as this. Okay? If we make it to the point of birth, if we're not aborted or if we're not miscarried, we are born. What's the cause of death? Birth. Yeah. Birth, from the moment we are born, we are aging, even while in the womb, and we are getting closer to the moment of death. Okay? So that's how these interact. How many lifetimes would it take to include all those? What's the minimum number of lifetimes? Can't be done in one, because there's rebirth, okay? Can you do it in two lifetimes? How many people say yes? Yeah, you can do it in two lifetimes. That's the quickest it can be done. It can be spread out over three lifetimes, okay, but it can be done in two lifetimes, okay? And act a strong, very ignorant, okay, very attached to self, very strong negative action. Say we killed one of our parents, that would be considered a really, and we wanted to do it, and we were glad to do it. That would be a very, very, very strong karmic seed. And if the craving and grasping were appropriate, that could ripen at the time of death and determine our next rebirth. Okay? We would be reborn, name and form, six sources, contact, feeling, birth, and old age. So it's all accomplished within two lifetimes. Okay, say there's a negative action, but it's not that strong. That can be placed on our consciousness. And say again, it's a negative action, but not that strong. It's placed on our consciousness. It is not strong enough to be the throwing karma for the next rebirth. Some other karma is the throwing karma, but that one specific one that I'm talking about is still there. Through this lifetime, through the next lifetime, could be through 5, 10 lifetimes. At some point in the future, the craving and grasping becoming karma allows that seed to ripen and you go into the next rebirth. Okay, so that particular cycle would be over three lifetimes, but there would be an enormous gap in between the first two, or it's possible. I mean, you could have 1,000 lifetimes according to the teachings in there, but then the next two would be sequential, okay, when it, name and birth, old age and death, okay?
So are we saying that we don't go around the wheel sequentially?
Right, exactly. It's not sequential. Yeah, this is just, you know, it seems we want to organize, I think just the way we're taught in the West, we want to organize into sequences, and that's not the way the Tibetans think about this.
Everything is still interdependent.
Yeah, and they're all linked to each other, but it's not neat and tidy. You do this one, then you move on to the next one necessarily. Okay? Any other questions? Okay. People getting a sense of how this works now. This is what keeps us in samsara, okay? Ignorance creates karma placed on the consciousness, okay? Then the craving and grasping becoming allow that karma to ripen, forces us into this sequence of interacting with the world, old age and death. And we start over again, okay? Then another, at the moment of death, another seed on the consciousness will ripen and throw us into the next lifetime. So we have countless number of these links going on our mind stream at any one time. You know, we're most aware of being in old age and death, but we're also creating the karmic seeds that will ripen in the future. Our throwing karma and then all our other karma. Okay? So this explains why we stay in samsara. If we want to get out of samsara, we start to think about reversing things, okay? Old age and death. Who likes old age and death? Who wants to experience old age and death? Anybody looking forward to the moment of death? Anybody looking forward to getting older than they are already? Finding that an inherently pleasurable activity? No, we want to avoid that, okay? So, to avoid that, we have to avoid being born in samsara. This doesn't mean we want to avoid, go out of existence, but we want to live in a non-samsaric existence, okay? So we don't want to be born into a samsaric existence. How do we eliminate being born into a samsaric existence? Okay? We remove the conditions that allow that kind of karma to ripen. Okay? So we work on this. Okay? We work on feeling the connection. How do we remove those? We start to cut the connection between craving and feeling. And then we can just work backwards. And ultimately, I mean, these are all things we can work on now. But the ultimate, well, actually, there are a couple ways. There are a couple ways to break this cycle, okay, to cut it, to prevent this negative karma from ripening and suffering. What's the first one? We do a lot of it here at the center. Purification, right, okay. Purification means removing, weakening the imprints of the negative karma that we've created. Okay. For first, just stopping it so it's not growing. Because we're told karma expands over time. So when we do purification practice, we're stopping that negative karma from expanding. Okay. We're slowing down its ripening. We're preventing it from ripening. And ultimately, if we're doing our purification practice perfectly, it said we're actually removing negative karma from our mind stream. What are the four components of purification practice? Yeah, you're getting them, but not in the right order. Yeah. Uh-huh. First is you regret doing it. Reliance, which means going for refuge to your spiritual guides. Yeah, uh-huh. Okay. Let's see. Regret. I'm sorry I did it. Not I'm a bad person, but I'm sorry I did it because it's going to keep me in this wheel of sorrow. You know, that's a positive emotion in the Buddhist point of view, that kind of regret. Not guilt is worthless from the Buddhist point of view. You know, it's just a complete waste of time, but regretting that you've done this negative action that's going to keep you in samsara, that's great, okay? Regret. The next one is reliance, which means going for refuge or to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha if you're Buddhist. Okay, the third one is the remedy, which can be something as simple as saying a mantra, doing a meditation practice. If it's, of course, if you know, if you've hurt someone and you can actually go and repair the damage you've done, you know, apologize to them, make it up to them, that's a lot better than just say, oh, I'll just say some mantras. I don't really have to go talk to them. Yeah, you can, mind can play tricks. So you do some sort of remedy. That's where a teacher can be very useful. You say, you know, what kind of remedy would be appropriate for this? And then the last one is resolve. Say, I'm not going to do it again for at least a week or something. Be realistic with yourself. So you need those four R's for it to be a complete purification practice. So that lessens the strength of this negative karma. So that's one way to at least slow down this wheel. But if we want to stop it completely, we have to deal with ignorance. Okay, that's where all the problems come. So we can work back through here. Okay, and we can do, you know, spiritual training where, you know, where we work on feelings. Well, feelings are hard to work on, but we eliminate craving as much as we can from our mind stream. But if we really want to get, we have to eliminate ignorance. And that means meditating on the ultimate nature of reality. And that's something that we start off when we approach intellectually, and it seems very dry sometimes. And then we kind of incorporate it into our way of being till it becomes a direct experience when we actually see things as they are. We don't have to sit and think, oh, that's not real. I don't believe in it. Someone, I was reading an example today, said it's like seeing some, this time of year, seeing someone dressed up as Santa Claus. Okay? We're at the state where, in terms of seeing reality, we see someone dressed as Santa Claus, and we believe he's Santa Claus, and we believe he's the real Santa Claus. Okay? Then the next state is to move on not believing in what we see. So, yes, we see someone who's dressed up as Santa Claus, but he's not Santa Claus, and there is no real Santa Claus. Okay? So we're in the state of seeing some fat guy dressed up as Santa Claus and saying he is the real Santa Claus whenever we see him. So not a very accurate way of seeing things, to go through the world and seeing everyone as Santa Claus just because they're wearing a red outfit. Any other questions or comments? I've been running my mouth a lot here. Do people get a sense of how the links are interacting now? Yeah, let's see. Okay.
If someone were a Buddha and they were to look at us,
mm-hmm.
would they see where we are on our wheel in terms of multidimensionally understanding our relationship with karma?
I think so, yeah. I think a Buddha sees everything that exists as it is. So they see our karma and everything that's going on, supposedly. Yeah, Buddha sees everything that exists. Yeah, that's what they say. They can see the scope of the mess that we're in. I like that phrase, yes. Yeah, that's an interesting question. The Buddha, does a Buddha feel sad when they see the mess we're making of our lives? And so the question is, one, is sadness suffering? I think it's very different. You know, this, you know, what their response is really compassion, the wish that we, that they say, God, I wish you weren't suffering. I can see it, and you know, I can see how you're the creating the cause for this over and over again. And it's really pathetic. I can see it, and you can't, you know. And I wish you weren't doing that. And so it's that emotion is, or that feeling is referred to as compassion. And I heard one of the very high lamas said, we were talking about this, and something he said, and this is a long time ago, but I remember it. He says, the more compassionate you are, the happier you are. Compassion is not suffering, okay? It may have a characteristic of sadness, but it is not suffering, it is not painful for a Buddha. For us, our compassion is so mixed up in attachment. I don't want you to suffer because it makes me feel bad when you suffer. So it's a lot messier. But apparently for a Buddha, compassion is not suffering. I mean, that's, yeah. Yeah, suffering is basically impossible for a Buddha because suffering is a delusion. It's a misconception, really. It's based on ignorance, and that's not compatible with being a Buddha, being an enlightened being. The other point being where you're leaning, the Buddha can see how we're stuck in samsara, can see our karma, see how we're causing it, but the Buddha can't take it away. The Buddha is not an all-powerful God. The Buddha cannot change someone's karma or take away their suffering. All the Buddha can say is, this is what I did, and it worked for me. All the Buddha can do, really, is teach in the most skillful way that they know, which may be, you know, it may not be sitting on a cushion in front of a class. It may be being the rude checkout clerk at Food Lion that's teaching you a lesson you need to learn or something. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, so there's a practice where you go through life and where you're taught to see everyone as a Buddha. You know, it's just my deluded mind that can't see them as a Buddha. Other questions? Yeah. Yeah. Mhm. Yeah. They said, yeah, again, they give descriptions of this, and it gets very exact and precise about what actually happens. And I'm not really qualified to teach it, but they say when you first experience seeing things as they are, it's incredibly blissful, and you can stay with it for a little while, but you can't stay there permanently. You slip back into the old ways of seeing things, and then you gradually get to, my understanding is you gradually get to the point where you're going back and forth between the two and more quickly. And then you finally get to the point where you see there is a conventional sense in which we exist, in which this is a chair and you can sit down on it and you don't fall through it. It's not like it's non-existence. There's a conventional chair. It said that you get to the point where you see the conventional chair and the ultimate chair, the emptiness of the chair simultaneously, and they're not contradictory. But initially, my understanding is you go kind of back and forth between your old ways of thinking and the new ways. Uh-huh. But it said that that experience of seeing reality is incredibly blissful. I mean, very, you know, just because it's just like having an enormous burden taken off your back, especially when you see that there's no self beyond this body or mind, that you see that's all there is. There's the conventional self, but there's nothing beyond body and mind there. And so it would be a great, very blissful experience. And it said the bliss can almost be seductive in that you can kind of get stuck in just the bliss and ignore the rest of your spiritual path. Yeah, good question. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Okay. Let's see. Is there anything else I wanted to cover tonight? Okay, just to give you a little bit of terminology here. These first 2.5 links, ignorance, karmic formation, and then the imprinting of the karma on the consciousness are referred to as the causal links that throw. Okay? Causal links that throw. Okay? The consciousness that is thrown into the next lifetime, that moment, along with name and form, six sources, contact, and feeling, are referred to as the resultant links of what has been thrown. Okay, causal links that throw, resultant links that have been thrown, of what has been thrown. Okay, craving, grasping, and becoming are the causal links that actualize. Okay, these are the karmic conditions that allow a seed on the consciousness to actualize, to become active at the time of death. So causal here, resultant, and birth, old age, and death are the resultant links of what's actual. Okay? So you have two sets of causal links, really, and then two sets of resultant links. Okay? Causal links that throw, causal links that actualize, resultant links of what has been thrown, and resultant links of what is actual. Okay, those are just terms you may come across at some point. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Causal links that throw you into the next lifetime. And I'm going to go over here. Causal links that actualize, that allow a particular karmic seed to actualize at the time of death. Resultant links of what has been thrown. These are the results of the karmic seed that throws you into the next lifetime. And then the resultant links of what is actual, of what becomes actualized at the moment of rebirth. These two are really describing the same time period. This one's in a little bit more detail. Okay? And like I say, all these could manifest prior to actually being born, as we define it. These could all occur in the womb, and then that could be the end. But even in the womb, you're experiencing old age and death. So this just describes it in a little bit more detail. Other questions or comments? You got a reference there? Uh-huh, okay. Good. Correct me if I'm wrong on anything, please. And okay, yeah. This is a tough subject, and it's something that it takes really just sitting down and kind of chewing on it for a while. Okay, I think I've covered everything I want. Here's a comment Alex Berzin made that I think is applicable. When we start to think about this, you know, we have to be realistic about what we can do, and we have to realize over and over that we are in samsara. Okay, and that can be a very motivating factor to want to get out of it. Okay, but we have to be realistic about the fact that we're trying to do our spiritual practice while we're stuck in samsara. So if we're not a Buddha overnight, don't be disappointed by that. Be realistic. Okay, it's a reality that we're going to get sick, get old, and die. And we have to accept that. But this wish to be free from samsara, is really compassion for ourselves. Okay, the wish that we be free of suffering is developing compassion for ourselves, and we really have to do that before we can develop compassion for others. Okay, we can't develop true compassion for other people being stuck in samsara and suffering till we see that as our own experience and see how it affects us. So the point is not to meditate on this and get depressed. The point is to meditate on and become motivated and to understand how your own experience works and to start to see how it applies to other people, and you develop a real compassion. But it's not to get depressed. And if you find that that's happening, you know, you've kind of gone off track and you may want maybe just set this topic aside and meditate on something else. Okay? But it's really to motivate you to get out of samsara. Okay? Okay, so let's sit quietly for a couple minutes and just do a brief review meditation. So again, check your posture. And take a moment and set your motivation. And just a couple minutes of focusing on the breath to settle the mind and let all the words calm down. And we'll do just a brief review meditation of the 12 links. It's just reviewing, that's all it is, but with a very concentrated, focused mind, just so we get a little bit more clear about what we're talking about. The first link is ignorance, by which we mean primarily the ignorance of self. The inability to see how I really exist. The ignorance that believes that I exist in a way that is really impossible. I can't exist the way I think I do. The way I actually exist is very different. Following ignorance, we come to karmic formation, actions of mind, speech, and body, motivated by ignorance. That make an imprint on my consciousness. And at some point in the future, the karmic seed of that action, motivated by ignorance, throws me. I have no choice about it. I'm just being hurled by the catapult of my karma into my next lifetime, where the body and mind, name and form that come together, are determined by that karmic seed. body and mind come together, leading to the development of the six sources or six senses. Through these senses, I make contact with the external world. Contact inevitably leads to feeling, a pleasant feeling, an unpleasant feeling, or a neutral feeling. Feeling leads to craving of more pleasant experiences, of fewer unpleasant experiences. Craving leads to grasping, and in particular the grasping at the body and mind as the moment of death approaches. The unwillingness to let go, the fear of losing this body and mind. And because of that grasping, the karmic conditions for becoming are created, allowing the throwing karma to ripen into birth. Birth inevitably leads to old age and death. At which time another karmic seed throws me into the next lifetime. Not chosen, uncontrolled, under the influence of ignorance. And you can do a brief dedication. That is the end of this class. If you are doing it for credit, to get a certificate of having created, or of having completed all the Discovering Buddhism modules, there's a completion form that you need to fill out and sign, and then there's an essay question that you need to do over the next month. Put these in my mailbox out there. The answer to your essay question can be no more than 2 pages long, okay? People love to write great essays on these, but it slows me down reading through them, which I do in very slowly, but I do read them all. So, yeah, it's very simple. It's how would your life, physically, emotionally, spiritually, be different if you developed a complete understanding, realization of the 12 links? Okay? So if you're doing it for credit, please pick these up and try and get them back into my box by the first of the year. That would be nice. There's no Discovering Buddhism for the rest of the year. I don't think is there anything on Monday nights? Do you know? Yeah, okay. So I'll pick up again in January. And if you'd like to make a donation to support Kadampa Center, their donation box is outside. And we really depend on the donation of individuals to keep the doors open. We have no outside sources of funding beyond the people who come here and find value in the teachings. And yeah, we have Venerable Rabina, an outstanding, dynamic, charismatic Buddhist teacher who will be here for the second half of January and the first part of February. So that's something to look forward to. And up-to-date schedules and information are always on our website. And have a great holidays. Yeah, thank you. Yes. Yeah, yeah. Geshe Gelick is back in town after going on holiday, so he'll be here on Wednesday nights. So I'll just leave these here and people can help themselves.